Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another amazing gay woke episode of Blood, Sweat, and Strife, the gayest podcast ever. My name is May, and my pronouns are she, they.
I'm Jeremy, my pronouns are he, him.
I'm Aiden, my pronouns are also he, him.
Who are you?
Your mom.
What? Wait, what the fuck?
Who has invaded our safe space?
Me.
It's you. It's Aiden.
Hello. Hello.
Yeah.
I am worker. I do work.
He does the work. But yeah, Aiden is a good friend of ours. He's very well read and a really funny guy. But we decided to bring him on because Izzy's been feeling a little bit under the weather lately, and we wanted Aiden to come and lend his expertise and fill out the podcast a little bit. So I'm really excited to get into today's topic, and I'm really excited to be talking to you guys. So, how's everybody doing?
Pretty all right.
Pretty all right?
Just chilling.
That's good.
Just chilling. Pretty all right.
Yeah. But yeah, for today's topic, last time in this series, we covered a lot of the early, like, homosexual history in the United States and, like, LGBTQ history in the United States. And today, we are not only going to be covering the Lavender Scare, but we are also going to be covering the responses and resistance to the Lavender Scare, which were happening all over the country during this period of time, because whenever the government cracks down, there's always going to be resistance against it. So, should we just get right into it?
Yeah, that works.
All right.
Let's get right into the news.
Right into the news. But yeah, so when we last left off, it was the beginning of the Lavender Scare. This was going on in the early 1950s. It kind of officially kicked off in 1950. And it was spearheaded by the senator, Joseph McCarthy, who had several projects going on at once. Not only was he persecuting communists, but he was also persecuting gay people. And this prompted a lot of different responses and a lot of different ways that LGBT folk started to not only view themselves, but to view the society around them. And it was because of this persecution that they started to organize. So the first group that we are going to be talking about today is the Madison Society. And they were a secret organization which was founded in 1950 by the communist organizer Harry Hay, along with some other leftists in LA. And this was an organization of mostly gay men who were seeking to advance the interests of gay people.
More like Harry Gay.
Exactly. before we get into how the Madison Society was actually structured, I want to talk a little bit about Harry Hay and his history with the various, like, radical movements which were going on in the United States at the time. So, Harry Hay was born of American parents in England in 1912, but he spent most of his childhood and adolescence in Southern California. In 1930, he enrolled in Stanford, where he developed an interest in theater, and by God, them bitches were gay. Like, he got into the theater scene, he started meeting with other gay people and people who shared his political worldview, and in 1933... he became involved with propagandistic theater activities and participated in the general strike of 1933. And if you go back and read how he felt about this general strike, he was very emotionally invested in this strike. He said it was an incredible thing to be a part of, and it kind of spurred him on to become deeply involved with the Communist Party, where he would work doing a lot of, like, theater type stuff and educational type stuff, and he would further his own communist politics. In 1938, however, because of like pressures from society around him, pressures from a psychologist or a psychiatrist whom he came under the tutelage of and educated him in like Jungian psychoanalysis, and because of pressure from party members, he married a woman named Anita Plattke in 1938 and lived a pseudo-heterosexual life for a period of time until eventually he left that relationship because he had been meeting up with guys for sneaky links because this whole time he was suppressing his sexuality, which is sad. It's a sad thing when that happens. And I believe in the early 50s, he left this relationship. Also, just like a side note, in 1948, he was really involved with the presidential campaign of Henry Wallace, who was running against Harry S. Truman, that bastard. And Wallace was running on a platform of desegregation, racial and gender equality, and a national health insurance program. So, looking into this guy's history, he was very left-wing and definitely a gay person. And when the Lavender Scare would first kick off, he would respond to this by founding the Madison Society. And initially, the Madison Society was a very underground, secretive organization because they had to be secretive in order to survive. So yeah, the Madison Society had a centralized leadership with five orders. Harry Hay and the other founders comprised the top layer with four layers beneath them, and these lower layers were organized into cells, which were largely unknown to each other. So the people in each cell of the organization, as far as the individual cells go, the people in each individual cell knew each other, even though they were using aliases, but the activities of each cell were largely unknown to the cells surrounding it. And this structure was modeled after the Communist Party. So Harry Hay basically took his experience with the Communist Party and used that to model a party of his own, which would advance the interests of mostly gay men at the time. However, they would expand to and link up with like other organizations who were representing like lesbian groups, for example. So once again, this was a predominantly male group. And these men believed that the contradictions embedded in society created persecution, and that gays were trapped in a false consciousness, because the heterosexual standard imposed on them created feelings of inadequacy and incorrectness. And what I'd really like to talk about right now and open up for discussion is the difference between a class existing in itself and a class existing for itself. And to just kind of briefly give my thoughts on that subject, there are many classes in themselves in our society. Like LGBT people are a class in themselves. Disabled people, which I am one of them, are a class in themselves. And this is because of how the dominant superstructure interacts with these different groups. And it persecutes them, it segregates them, it pushes them off to the side, and it creates this identity group and this class which has interests which are opposed to the system, because the system is doing all these terrible things to them. So when a class recognizes itself not only as a class in itself, but a class for itself, that just means that they have become aware of their own interests. And I think a big, like, drawback that I see with a lot of LGBT liberals is that they don't really recognize themselves as a distinct class with their own interests, Rather, they recognize themselves as either, if you're more privileged, you recognize yourself as somebody who is working your job, as somebody who has integrated into society in some ways, once again, if you're privileged, instead of as a group and a class which has interests which are directly opposed to the capitalist system, and a class which should be fighting against the capitalist system.
I think, I think many gays, especially, like, more, like, upper middle class, like, liberal gays, in general tend to be, or, like, tend to view a lot of their antagonism as coming from, seemingly, like, redneck or, like, lower-class white people or just seemingly working-class people in general. So a lot of the times, like, it kind of muddies the water on where, like, a lot of their, like, primary antagonisms lie and a lot of where, like, even though there's this bigotry that's there, it overrides a lot of the, like, intersections between, like, the LGBTQ plus and the, like, greater working class in general.
Yeah, definitely. I feel that with a lot of, like, LGBT liberals or people who don't necessarily identify as, like, against the capitalist system, they view prejudice in a very individualistic way. They view it as, like, there are these people who exist in my country who are
bad actors,
yeah, and they're trying to take away my rights because they hate me. There's endless conversations we can have about, like, the reactionary nature of the working class in America, but at the end of the day, it's not individuals, especially not, like, lower class individuals, who are the ones that are going to take away your rights. It's going to be the people that they elect to the system, which sell them this line that the reason your life sucks is because of the pronouns or because of the immigrants or because of whatever scapegoat group they name.
They put it on the like, quote-unquote queerness, rather than the reaction to the queerness.
Yeah.
I think it kind of relates a little bit to the caste system that exists in India, where it's, like, this social hierarchical system that purposefully puts certain people on top, and everybody else underneath them is essentially worthless, but the people on top will say, oh, if you can manage to move up to this caste, then you'll be worth slightly more than you were when you were in that other caste.
Yeah.
And it fits. It's not quite organized the same in the US, but or in other Western societies, but it's kind of a similar thing where there's a superstructure with is clearly weighted towards the top.
Yeah, like, our society is designed more as, like, this loose spectrum of strata rather than a rigid set of, like, outline things.
But it still works the same way.
Yeah.
By design. It still has, but they strata, keep it loose, it so we can't that, point.
Yeah,
but that way people can't point to it and say, hey, you know, we're judging this thing and saying that it's bad, but we have the same thing.
Right.
But this way they can point and say, no, like, we're not a rigid caste system. It's just the free market or whatever excuse they use, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Their divine mandate is just, instead of, like, some kind of, like, divine thing, it's just the market. It's portrayed as natural.
Even though it probably stems from Catholicism anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's, like, a whole conversation to be had about, liberalism and the ideology kind of underpinning it. But getting back to the like initial point, I feel that looking at oppression through a very individualistic lens where you are thinking to yourself, it's just a matter of these bad people that don't want me to have rights. And if we could just get rid of those bad people, then everything would be fine. It doesn't work like that. How power operates is very opportunistic. And as we discussed in the last episode, during the Lavender Scare, the Republicans, who were the opposition party at the time to the current administration, really glommed on to homosexuality as a big issue. And they pushed this narrative that it was unnatural, it was predatory, it was evil, and they used this to attack the current administration, which was a little bit more tolerant of LGBT people, and brand them as weak and pansies and sissies and whatever. So it's this thing where as long as there is a system where they can take advantage of these groups, they're going to do it for personal gain. Okay, so getting back into the notes a little bit. So the purpose of the Mashin Society was to unify isolated homosexuals, to educate homosexuals to see themselves as an oppressed minority, and to lead them in a struggle for their emancipation. So, like, education is very important, learning history is very important, and they were trying to give people a radical education so they could understand their contemporary position to the system which was oppressing them. They gained notoriety after winning the entrapment case of Dal Jennings, who had been arrested by a plainclothes officer, held for several hours and charged with lewd conduct. So they were fighting court cases. They actually, one of the things that the Mashin Society had was a legal aid division, which would help people who had been entrapped by police. And as we go on, we're going to see this becoming a more and more prevalent thing. Like, they, with the way that homosexuals were being cracked down on, there was a response to it, and oftentimes it was these gay groups coming to the aid of people who needed legal assistance, because organizations like the ACLU wouldn't start representing gay people until like sometime in the 1960s. So really all gay people had at the time was solidarity from other gay people, because it really did feel like the whole of society had just turned against them. The Mashin Society also started founding a lot of newspapers. There was a newspaper called One, which was founded in Los Angeles in 1952 and funded by the Mashin Society and the Daughters of Bilitis, which we'll get into the Daughters of Bilitis more later, but they were a lesbian rights group. And this newspaper helped spread the word of the Mashin Society, and this caused chapters to start popping up all over the country. So the Mashin Society was growing. And up until 1953, they had this secret cell-like structure where there were individual cells who were all doing different activities, but one cell wouldn't be aware of another cell's activities. And this helped to keep everybody safe. Once again, they were also very communist. But in May 1953, at the height of McCarthy's influence, there were burning fears in the Mashin Society over the leadership's communist leanings. And this culminated in a May 1953 convention, which had some pretty significant outcomes for the organization. So, although the Mashin Society voted with the leadership, rejecting calls for an anti-communist statement by the org, Harry Hay and the other founding members of the Mashin Society decided to leave the org. And they left the Mashin Society because they felt that their communist politics would restrain the organization's growth, which, in my opinion, was a very noble thing of them to do. Because they were like, at that point, they were like, this is much bigger than us. This organization needs to grow unrestricted by our communist hangups, and we're going to leave it up to this new leadership, which I did some reading into the new leadership, and I have a lot of disagreements with them. They pushed an accommodationist approach centered around appealing to professionals and lawmakers. So the Mashin Society started out very radical, very anti-capitalist, very much against the prevailing view of the time that homosexuality was a mental illness or a disease, and the medical model implied that there was a cure. So how these accommodationists would approach the situation of trying to advance the rights of gay people were by basically trying to influence like doctors and other members of the professional class, like sociologists and whatnot, and also politicians to try to see LGBT stuff in a different light. They tried to appeal directly to the oppressors, and they didn't really get anywhere for a little while. But yeah, as far as how the org would organize itself, it would now be composed of an elected coordinated council with the authority to establish working committees. So no more secretive cell-like structure. Now we're doing an open democratic structure with working committees, which isn't really necessarily a bad idea in theory, but at the time it was kind of a bad idea because the government and the police were going after people like this. And that's where we'll leave the Mashin Society for this section of the episode. They will become relevant again in a little bit, as more people would join the organization and a change in character of the organization would take place. But right now, that's where we're going to be leaving that off. So now I'm going to come to a section in the notes called What About the Lesbians?
What about the lesbians?
What about them? Because we spent a lot of time talking about gay men. And I want to make this as inclusive as possible. But yeah, so with the topic of lesbians in this whole thing, we're going to be going back to the Victorian era. So during the Victorian era, middle-class lesbian women would basically lead lives of repressed lesbianism. They would either marry to a man and just kind of generally be miserable, or they would move in with friends, or quote-unquote friends, and they would carry out lesbian relationships in secret because it was still a big taboo. It was still something that a lot of people just weren't allowed to practice in a lot of places in the world. In the 1920s, there were studies correlating education to lesbianism, suggesting that the ability to earn an income that supports your lifestyle allowed for more experimentation. And this is something that would kind of be a recurring theme. Like, oftentimes it was women of the professional class who had the money and the resources to not have to marry to a man. And this was a matter of, like, labor. Like, if you were an educated woman working as like a professor or something like that, like you would have the resources necessary to like lead your life in a way that you wanted to lead it, while still having to keep it kind of secretive. In this era as well, once again, like the 1920s, Freudian psychoanalysis contributed to lesbianism being pathologized as an illness, and this was a common thing for gay men as well. And then there was the progressive era, which had the like suffragettes movement, and all these women were protesting for the right to vote, and a bunch of women's groups were forming. But after the progressive era, these women's groups kind of scattered, and there weren't really a lot of options for lesbian women to like organize politically. So that's how things were for the middle class. But what about the working class? So working class women tended to work in sweatshops, factories, or domestic employment when single, and they worked in the home after marriage. They lived in cramped urban conditions, and this allowed very little room for a cult of domesticity to form. And basically what is meant by that is, think about the 1950s. Think about the stereotypical housewife with the duties of like keeping the house clean and picking up after the man and being submissive and all that other stuff. But since they were living in cramped urban conditions, they did not really have the inclination towards consumer products and this lifestyle of just pure subservience to men. And working class ethics did not endorse female pairings. There were a lot of people in the working class who still believed in the traditional pairing of a man and a woman, or traditional for the past like 100 years or so. There were women who cross-dressed, and one such instance of this was Lucy Ann Lobdell, who began cross-dressing in 1850 to do men's work and earn men's wages, and this wasn't an uncommon thing for lesbians. And Lucy Ann Lobdell said of her decision to do this, "Is it any wonder that I determined to become a member of this privileged sex if possible? The woman who must work is a slave. With the present wage conditions, there are thousands of young women who are living in a state of semi-starvation." So I think that, like, the inclination that a lot of women had to cross-dress came from a place of economic insecurity, and they wanted better conditions and better lives for themselves. But also, I think that some of these people were just trans mask. Like, there are definitely stories of, like, trans mask people going back before the 1800s, but also, like, in the 1800s and the 1900s. And some women who decided to dress up as men, and they probably were just men, like, they were happier that way, and well, for some of them, it may have just been a costume that they donned to gain opportunity. It was also a way of expressing yourself. Jumping forward a little bit, after Prohibition, bars for lesbians started popping up, long after the bars for gay men. The relatively low number of lesbian bars made them all the more important as cultural expressions of lesbianism. So I'm not exactly sure why there was this big disparity, between, like, bars for gay men and bars for women, but this could just be due to... Actually, I don't know what this was due to, so I'm not gonna speculate. But yeah, eventually bars for lesbians started popping up. And another note that I have here is about the butch femme dichotomy. So, like, in lesbian relationships, there's often this, like, stereotype that one of them is more feminine and, like, girly, and the other one is more masculine and butch. And this is just something that was socially imposed on people. This was not something that actually had any rooting in, like, sociological science or anything like that. It was literally just like, well, one of you has to be the man, right? And many who didn't neatly fit into one category or the other were ostracized and seen as confused and mixed up. So, like, even though, like, this was a dumb, socially imposed thing, this was something that affected a lot of lesbians. And a lot of lesbians who did not fit into these categories were seen as, once again, confused or mixed up. But, yeah, jumping forward again a little bit, after World War II, when all of the men returned home from the war, the average age at marriage lowered, the birth rate jumped sharply, and the rate of marriage reached a peak unsurpassed in the nation's history. So, during wartime, there was a culture forming of, like, women's independence and even women's liberation. Like, they were taking over these industrial factory jobs. They were earning higher wages. However, once the men returned home, many women lost their high-paying industrial jobs. And there was a resurgence on prescriptive literature on a woman's place, which, like we were talking about, the call of domesticity, basically just meant that you were supposed to get married and have kids and look after your husband and clean up the house. And this was part and parcel with the big conservative backlash which was happening at the time against gay people and against communists, because, like, there have always been feminists around. It's just that most feminists are on the left, and if you're a feminist who's not on the left, then I'd question if you're really a feminist. So, yeah, a lot of repression and propaganda got pumped out during that time. And organizing was more difficult for women given their smaller numbers and economic precarity. So for a long time, there weren't really, there was a sense of community with lesbians, but there weren't really a lot of, like, organized groups up until 1955, when Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon founded the Daughters Abilitis, which was taken from the poem The Songs Abilitis, which is a poem exploring lesbian romance, or a series of poems exploring lesbian romance. So Del Martin married a man, divorced him after she fell in love with a neighbor woman, and had to juggle work with raising a child. So that's a little bit about her and the conditions that drove her to found a society like the Daughters Abilitis. And eventually the Daughters Abilitis teamed up with the Madison Society and was similar in their outlook. The Daughters Abilitis focused on education and reform at that period of time. They started a newspaper called The Ladder to give a voice to lesbians. Madison's leaders viewed the Daughters Abilitis in a condescending way, though, immediately viewing them as a women's auxiliary. However, in the Daughters Abilitis Constitution, there is a provision allowing the DOB from affiliating with another group, or disallowing the DOB from affiliating with another group. So, they were still an independent organization, they still had their own stuff, it's just that the Madison Society's leaders viewed them as kind of like...
They were being sexist.
They were being sexist. They really were.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They kind of immediately took a pejorative stance on it and just, like, decided that they were, like, a guiding hand.
Yeah.
An ironically reactionary take to have.
Yeah. I mean, like, we see this, like, even today. Like, I hear stories all the time, and I've experienced, like, instances where I have been, excluded from something or excluded from an identity group based on, like, how I present or how I am. And there are LGBT people who are fine with, like, certain types of LGBT people. So, but, like, not fine with other types of LGBT people. So,
yeah, the good ones.
The good ones.
The quote-unquote good ones.
Yeah, so, like, even among, like, LGBT people, there's still a chance for these people to form reactionary stances and to not stand in solidarity with one another. And something that I really want to, like, combat with this series is the notion that there can be liberation for just one group of people. In order to have a movement that can actually challenge power, it has to run the gambit of all different types of groups. It has to have women's groups, it has to have LGBT groups, it has to have groups of racial minorities, groups of indigenous people. And we don't do ourselves any favors by excluding anybody.
Or trying to make their decisions for them.
Exactly. So, yeah. We all have different perspectives and different interests and different things that we'd like to be done. And in order to accomplish those goals, we need to work together. Like, yeah. So, with the Daughters of Bilitis, even though they were a growing organization and they showed a lot of promise in some ways, organizing along the lines of a lesbian identity was still pretty hard. Workers were too precarious to take the risk. There were lesbians in hetero relationships rearing children, and professional women didn't want to risk their careers by joining the Daughters of Bilitis. The organization was kind of a revolving door for helping women get their lives in order. And this contributed to the low numbers, because a lot of people would join and leave and join and leave. The Daughters of Bilitis members were encouraged to wear feminine dress so as to be more acceptable to society. Once again, taking the accommodationist approach, where they basically wanted to model themselves after the image of what straight society wanted out of them. And the lesbian bar culture remained larger than the Daughters of Bilitis. So I have one more note here on this stuff. And that's once again is on the magazine One. And they regularly publish stories of police entrapping and harassing gay people. Well, the Madison Review and the latter took a more restrained approach. They would focus more on the closings of gay bars and legal developments which could be positive for gay people, and attempt to accommodate the system in whatever way they could. They were hoping to educate away what they viewed as a self-image problem among gay people, and to reach establishment professionals, whom they viewed as key figures in their liberation. So, just going off of that note, they weren't doing a lot to advance the cause. Like, having, like, a lesbian organization was definitely a good thing. But, like, in their...
It acted more as, like, a support group than as a, like, revolutionary organization, which is fine.
Yeah. However, I think that there were, like, a lot of shortcomings to their approach. Like, it's good to have a support group for LGBT people. However, the approach that they took was a reformist, accommodationist approach. They wanted to present themselves in a nice way for heterosexual society so they could maybe ask for their rights. They wanted to ask for their rights politely. And as history shows us, not much really gets accomplished on a systemic level when you are just politely asking. You have to make a big fuss. You got to go out. You got to protest. You got to do direct action. And these organizations at this period of time, given like the Red Scare and the Lavender Scare, they kind of retreated into respectability, as the book that I've been pulling from, Sexual Politics, Sexual Communities by John D'Amelio, puts it. And another thing that I want to discuss with this discussion on LGBT issues is that organizations can change a lot over time. As we are going to see, the Mashin Society and the Daughters of Bilitis would have significant changes in their organization throughout the 1960s. So far, we've been focusing on the 1800s to the 1950s, but as we get more into the 60s, new people are going to enter these organizations, and they're going to have a much more radical worldview. And I think how we're going to end today's episode is by talking about Franklin Khomeini, who was very cool, and I really like him a lot, and he had a lot of great things to say about the homosexual and LGBT movement, which was happening at the time. So, Franklin.
Oh, before we do that, I'd just like to, sorry, I didn't want to, I should have brought this up before, but I didn't want to break your flow because you were going through everything so smoothly. But kind of going way back, to the point about women working the factory jobs and everything during World War II, it sort of is a perfect example of the thing that you spoke about before, where, you know, there are classes within classes and classes that are all to themselves, and it shows that when you compare it to today, for example, with the pandemic, and how the quote-unquote essential workers that worked jobs that might not necessarily have been essential, like fast food workers and stuff, got a little bit more respect during the pandemic. And then as soon as the pandemic was declared over by our lovely president, the respect started to wane again.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of similar to that, where like women could obviously do these jobs and deserved the same pay as men got, but as soon as the men came back, they started to get disrespected again.
Yeah.
Because like us, we're in the working class, and then the women are like a subset of the working class that are sort of even more put down than like, obviously in a patriarchal society, it's going to be skewed towards the men, so like we're on the bottom rung, and then the women are even lower than that.
Yeah.
I say we as in like men, and then like even within other minority structures, you have the LGBTQ, and then the women of the LGBTQ are even lower than that, and then trans people in general are even lower than that.
Yeah.
And then even within that, trans women are lower than that, because they're the ones that everyone is outraged about. You know, you don't hear as much talk about trans men.
Mm-hmm. It's because they're horny for us.
It's true.
That's a lot of what it comes down to. But yeah,
it's just interesting to observe that class structure.
Yeah, I really like that point, especially the point about like the essential workers, because like it's almost like how I viewed all of that stuff about like essential workers being so brave and being so good for us and all that other stuff during like the height of things. I kind of viewed that as just them gearing us up to watch a lot of these people die. As grim as that sounds, but like they were making it out like they were the troops, and they're going to
they're heroes,
and they're going to lay down their lives for us so you can have your fucking burger or whatever.
Yeah.
And like a lot of the people that I knew at the time who were working service industry jobs were like, I wish they'd stop calling us essential. I wish they'd stop doing this patronizing bullshit and just pay me more money.
They're not heroes. They were slaves being forced to work or they died.
Exactly. And like today, like it's impossible to have a single income household, pretty much, unless you have a lot of like well saved up. And women are still paid less than men are. Like, things have gotten worse in a lot of ways because we don't have strong unions anymore, and because we still live in a very patriarchal society where women make less than men do, and this contributes to a sense of economic precarity. I think one of the best ways I've heard this summed up was in a tweet. And it just said, late...
You mean an X?
Yeah, a post on X. but it just said, like, ladies, if you ever feel bad about men buying you drinks, just remember there's a pay gap. And it's true. Like, it's just so messed up. So, just to kind of wrap up for the day... we're going to talk about Franklin Kameny a little bit on this episode, but I think we're going to really get more in depth with this stuff on the next episode. So just to give you a little bit of background on him, he was the one who spearheaded the gay militant movement of the 1960s. And he was born in 1925 to a Jewish family in New York City. He served in the army during World War II, finished college and went to get a PhD in astronomy at Harvard. So he was a pretty smart guy. He was a well-educated person. He was an astronomer. And he discovered his homosexual identity during a year of research at the University of Arizona. When he received a degree from Harvard in 1950, or he received a degree from Harvard in 1956, but then he lost his job in 1957 over 1956 lewd conduct charges. He took his case to the courts, but they ruled against him. And he was unable to find another position doing what he was trained in doing due to security concerns, which, as we talked about in the last episode, basically meant if you were a gay person or a drunkard, they would kick you out of government positions. The drunkard thing is, like, kind of funny, considering that all those motherfuckers drink and take drugs in the fucking government. but the security concern thing was basically just, like, yeah, we don't want any gay people in the government. And as far as his militancy went, he broke with the homophile movement in some key ways. Now, when I say militant, I don't necessarily mean he was picking up a gun and going out and doing anything with it. I mean that he had an anti-capitalist approach which broke from the accommodationists who wanted to influence public opinion through professionals and lawmakers and get their rights that way. And he said on this that... it is absolutely necessary to be prepared to take definite, unequivocal positions upon supposedly controversial matters. We should have a clear, explicit, consistent viewpoint, and we should not be timid in presenting it. And once again, this was very different from what the homosexual groups at the time were pushing, who mostly took a neutral stance on these issues, presenting both sides. So they would be like, on the one hand, we deserve rights. On the other hand, they're right, we're mentally ill, which is just a very self-hating stance to take. Frank Kameny disagreed with this stance and believed that presenting both sides only gave the other side ammunition to be used against them, which is true. If you are arguing that LGBT people deserve rights, you should not be using LGBT phobic talking points.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's important to see both sides. I don't care. We have to look at both sides of the argument to be fair.
No. None of that.
Is it being fair to question whether or not we have the right to exist?
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah.
Don't you know I'm a centrist and I'm so smart?
I see.
Yeah. But yeah, Khomeini believed that the gay movement should be modeled after the civil rights movement, favoring the tactics of social services, information education, and civil rights direct action. He believed direct action to be the most important component. So as the 60s would go on, we'd see a lot of direct action taken by gay people. They would organize protests and marches. They would march with signs. And they believe that by kind of modeling themselves after the civil rights movement, they would be able to achieve their liberation. And since they were still living under the capitalist system, and Franklin Khomeini had spent some time being very poor, either homeless or on the verge of homelessness, he adopted some anti-capitalist views. He said that one can supply virtually unlimited amounts of money, food, clothing, and shelter to the poor, but unless one gets to the root of the poverty, the economic system which produces unemployment, one will accomplish little of lasting value. He also disagreed with relying solely on education. He said that the Black American tried for 90 years to achieve his purposes by a program of information and education. His achievements in those 90 years, which by no means nil, were nothing compared to those of the past 10 years when he tried a vigorous civil liberties social action approach. And he also condemned contemporary medical models of homosexuality and conversion treatments. So, Franklin Khomeini is one of my favorite guys. Like, he had such a good, like, political line, and he became very important in the homophile movement, because he would, let me look at my note, he would eventually become involved in ECHO, or the East Coast Homophile Organizations, which was formed in 1963, and that combined the efforts of the Daughters of Bilitis, the New York Madison, and the Janus Society of Philadelphia, and the Washington Madison. So the more militant members of ECHO were the most dedicated and had an outsized voice, so this attracted more militants. So Franklin Khomeini was at the forefront of all of this. He was deeply involved in advocating for and fighting for the rights of gay people, and I think he deserves to be remembered and talked about, and we're going to be talking about him more on the next episode since we're almost out of time. But yeah, that's where we'll leave the homophile movements for today, and I want to open it up again now for final thoughts and some discussion.
I think in general, a lot of the formation of these groups and a lot of, like, the directions they took kind of makes sense. In the sense that, like, at the stage America's at and the stages America has been in, like, these groups seem to be, like, pretty, like the issues they're facing and the decisions they're making seem fairly normal for, like, how they're interacting with the situations around them. And I think things can be improving at a pretty good rate. And I think the fact that we have the ability to look back on these, and the fact that we have the ability to kind of, like, see exactly where these groups went wrong, or, like, where they, like, the, like, what lines exactly they took, and, like, how those lines affected what happened to them, I think it's pretty valuable overall.
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah, I think that the reason that radicalization keeps growing in movements like this is because, you know, year after year, the ability to access information gets easier and better. So we can see sort of how things shook out in the past and how to avoid those mistakes, like you were saying. I had another point, but now I forget.
You forgot.
Maybe forgot.
That's okay. But yeah, I want to comment on Aiden's point. While I was kind of like frustrated reading about like the little moments of like liberalization that happened with the Madison Society and with the Daughters of Bilitis, it also did make sense at the time, and
yeah,
it
was I think those stepping stone. I think the liberalization that these groups saw was a pretty like, it's not a surprising response to a lot of the way things have gone in the United States, because there have been like efforts from the government in general to try to make this less of an issue. And I think like a lot of the placation measures that they put forth have been somewhat successful, but have also led to like large reactionary backlashes that I think will bring the issue, will continue bringing the issue to the forefront again and again and again until, you know, capitalism is resolved.
Yeah. And like just going with the modern day, like we are seeing another red and lavender scare happening like mm-hmm. right now. Because like we talked about on the last episode in the series, like a lot of queer people are communists. Like, just look at this podcast. And they recognize that, and they recognize that queer people are not living as full citizens in the United States. In some places now, you're not even allowed to use the bathroom as a trans person. In other places, they're passing laws against, like, gender nonconforming clothing. In other places, they are passing laws against abortion, which affects people with uteruses. A lot of this kind of came from a reluctance to give us our rights in full. They are willing to placate us in some ways. They're willing to put forth a Supreme Court decision. But
they'll let the real problems fester until they get people killed, and even after.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that kind of reminds me of the point that I forgot about. So, along with placation, usually one of the first things that they try to do is remove the access to education on this stuff, like removing books from schools and libraries,
or replacing like curriculums with things like PragerU.
Yeah.
Yes, and that's probably why they're so they're reacting so fiercely to things like critical race theory,
right.
Or drag queen story hours,
like because it benign teaches fucking things, and it's still too much.
But God forbid we humanize people.
God forbid a person dress in drag and tell a story.
Yeah. But the critical race theory thing, it's like, obviously it's not something that's being taught to kids in low-level public schools, but it's still something that teaches the true history of the United States and how it was built on the backs of slaves. And that's something that they don't want everyday people to know, because the less people know about it, the less people will make a stink about it.
And I think oftentimes it's not even that we aren't aware of this fact. Like, a lot of racists will say, like, well, that happened so long ago, so people just need to get over it. But, like, slavery never really ended. Like, up until, like, the Civil Rights Movement in the 1960s, and even
think,
after that,
I think that's why a lot of people struggle to see like the impact of slavery, because of the way labor is organized in general, people think like, oh, well, if things only got slightly worse for them and things haven't even improved, I guess slavery wasn't like, must not have been so bad, I guess. I'm just trying to understand.
Some of the slave masters were nice to their slaves.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like this extension now to the capitalist, where not all capitalists are bad.
Yeah. But yeah, like a lot of people, like they don't have like a particularly good understanding of history, and they refuse to see the problems which are still facing so many people as systemic problems. Like, going back to the conversation we were having about, like, liberal LGBT people who might have a little bit more privilege, they don't recognize their oppression as a systemic thing. They recognize it as an individual thing. They think that there's a lot of prejudiced people out there who are at the root of them not being able to live as full citizens in their country. When in reality, while there is a lot of, like, reactionary tendencies in the working class and a lot of backlash, it's a matter of the ruling class using these things to separate us and keep us from establishing community and solidarity with one another. Because, like, we, at the end of the day, like, the vast majority of people are the working class, and if we all joined together and attempted to accomplish something that would give us our rights, then that would pose a huge threat to things as we know it today. So yeah, I think that's where we'll leave it today. And we'll see you all again in about 2 weeks. Have a lovely time. Stay safe out there. And this has been Blood, Sweat, and Strife. See you later.
See you later.